tuned to Yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's past. I'm Mark Levonier. In this hour, True History. Later on, the Hallmark Playhouse with a story about Abraham Lincoln from 1950. But right now, it's the You Are There series with CBS newsmen John Daly, Don Hollenbeck, and Ken Roberts covering the events of April 12, 1861, as if CBS News was actually there. This episode about the shot that began the Civil War, called Fort Sumter, heard on CBS on May 22, 1949.
This is Don Hollenbeck at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina. It's dawn here this morning of April 12, 1861. The long night of waiting is over. In a few minutes, we'll know if the United States is to be divided into two independent nations split by civil war. Major Robert Anderson, commander of Fort Sumter, is about ready to give his reply to the Confederate demand that he surrender this northern fortress in the heart of the seceded South. If Major Anderson does name a surrender date, that will be a sign the federal government is unable to maintain its authority in the slavery states. But if he refuses to yield Sumter, that will be a challenge to the concept of states' rights under which the Confederacy has been formed. The Confederate guns may then open fire on this fort, an act that would probably be the signal for a civil war between the North and the South. The officers gathered here in the guardroom at Fort Sumter have received no advance indication as to what Major Anderson will do.
April 12, 1861, Charleston, South Carolina. You are there.
States' rights or federal sovereignty. The North and the South confront each other at Fort Sumter. Will there be peace at the cost of union or civil war? CBS takes you back to the great crisis of the American Republic. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Charleston, the guardroom at Fort Sumter, and Don Hollenbeck.
South into civil war. There are about 15 officers and men here in the bare, gloomy, candlelit guardroom at Fort Sumter, a room sparsely furnished. It's about 25 feet long with a low vaulted ceiling. It's been a sleepless night. The Confederate delegation, headed by Colonel James Chestnut, arrived about 1 o'clock this morning, delivered the southern ultimatum to Major Anderson, commander of the fort. That ultimatum demands that Major Anderson name the day when he'll surrender Fort Sumter. It implies that force will be used if the major refuses to yield. Major Anderson and his staff went immediately into conference. They've been in the major's office these past 3 hours framing an answer. A moment ago, the major sent word by his orderly that he's about ready to reply, and we're waiting for him to appear. The three members of the Confederate delegation are sitting at the guardroom table with Colonel Chestnut, the head of the delegation, or Captain Stephen D. Lee, Lieutenant Colonel A.R. Chisholm, and one civilian, Congressman Roger Pryor of Virginia. The Southerners seem calm, confident, but the men of this federal garrison, on the other hand, are nervous and tense. They're running low on provisions. They've been almost blockaded for 3 weeks. Ever since the election of Abraham Lincoln last November on an anti-slavery platform, his election, of course, has brought this crisis between the North and South to a head. Oh, Major Anderson's just come into the guardroom. He's walking toward the Southern delegation at the table. Major Anderson's 56, tall, graduate of West Point, fought with distinction in the Indian and Mexican Wars. The major's from Kentucky. He's a slave owner himself, yet his sympathies are certain to be pro-union. Now Major Anderson has stopped at the table. Now he's facing Colonel Chestnut, the head of the Southern delegation.
General,
Major Anderson is speaking.
Forgive me for keeping you waiting so long. Important decisions are not made easily.
We appreciate that, sir.
Colonel, as I informed you earlier, Fort Sumter's food supplies are exhausted. Unless we receive provisions, we shall be starved out in 3 days. Please inform your government that I shall surrender Fort Sumter 3 days from now, on the 15th of April, unless, prior to that date, I receive new instructions from my government at Washington or additional provisions.
In other words, you refuse to surrender.
I just told you, Colonel. I will evacuate this fort on the 15th, unless...
That won't do, Major Anderson. My government will not accept a qualified answer. We know as well as you that Mr. Lincoln has dispatched a fleet to bring you provisions, and that fleet should arrive here sometime today. We want a hard and fast answer, no ifs or buts. We want your word that you will surrender this fort at once, immediately.
I can't do that, Colonel Chestnut. It would be a violation of my honor. I have an obligation to the government of the United States.
Major Anderson, you as a Southerner owe a sacred obligation to the people of the South.
An officer of the United States Army.
Sir, I have authority of Brigadier General Beauregard, commanding the provisional forces of the Confederate States of America. I have the honor to inform you that as soon as I reach our guns to give the command, we will open the fire of our batteries on Fort Sumter. Good day, sir.
Colonel Chestnut and Major Anderson exchange salutes. Colonel Chestnut and his party are leaving the guardroom now. It will take them some little time to row across the harbor to the nearest Confederate guns. Now Major Anderson has turned to talk to several officers who've gathered around him. As soon as he's finished, we'll try to get a word with him. The Major looks pale. There's an expression of great sadness on his face. He's been pushed into this situation. As we said, Major Anderson is from Kentucky, probably torn by conflicting loyalties to the South and to the federal government. The Major stopped talking to his officers. Major Anderson, sir, may we have a word with you, please?
Well, only a moment. I'm very busy.
I understand, sir. Major, do you think Colonel Chestnut will make good that threat to fire on you?
I hope not, sir. But if he does, we shall answer fire with fire.
Well, if the bombardment does take place, how long do you think you can hold out?
If a bombardment takes place, the fate of Fort Sumter won't matter. We shall then be concerned with civil war, with the fate of our country, sir.
Thank you very much, Major Anderson. The Major's leaving the guardroom. The other federal officers and soldiers are talking quietly now. Nothing they can do but wait. And now for some comments on Major Anderson's reply to Colonel Chestnut, we take you to our studios in Washington and Quincy Howe.
We've just heard Colonel Chestnut threaten to fire on Sumter without first consulting his government. That's the Confederate government at Montgomery, Alabama. That's strange. You'd really think in such a crisis as this, that Colonel Chestnut would telegraph Major Anderson's reply to his superiors in Montgomery. Then Confederate President Jefferson Davis would have had to make the decision whether or not to wait for Fort Sumter to surrender on the 15th of April. But apparently Colonel Chestnut just didn't do that. He pointed out that a federal provision fleet is steaming toward Sumter, and he threatened to open fire on the fort in a few minutes. Of course, it may well be that the colonel is just bluffing, hoping the threat will cause Major Anderson to surrender right away, before the food ships arrive, that is. Major Anderson still has time to indicate surrender. He can raise a white flag or lower the stars and stripes from Fort Sumter's mast. If Major Anderson does not surrender, and if Colonel Chestnut means what he says, the decision on peace or war lies with President Abraham Lincoln right here in Washington. The president can still, of course, telegraph Major Anderson instructions to surrender Fort Sumter. That would avoid an open, an armed conflict between the North and the South. I've just been informed that President Lincoln is about to speak to reporters at the White House. Doug Edwards is there. So we take you now to the White House, and go ahead, Doug Edwards.
The doors to the president's sitting room have just been opened, and correspondents from every section of the country, including the South, are entering. President Lincoln is sitting at the desk. With Mr. Lincoln are his personal secretary, Mr. Hay, and the Secretary of State, Mr. Seward. Mr. Lincoln shows the strain of waiting for telegraph bulletins from the fort. He looks very tired. His face is drawn, his shoulders are bent, and his black coat is wrinkled. The sitting room door has just been shut. The next voice you hear will be that of President Abraham Lincoln.
Gentlemen, you know by now that the guns of the Confederacy threaten to open fire on Fort Sumter. The senior officer of the fort, Major Anderson, has refused to surrender unless he receives instructions to do so from me. The country has a right to know where I stand on this question. My position was made clear in my inaugural address. At that time, I said, acts of violence within any states against the authority of the United States are revolutionary. I said further, the Constitution expressly enjoins upon me that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states. I said the power confided in me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the places and property of the government. And that includes Fort Sumter. Now, gentlemen, I shall be glad to answer your questions to the best of my ability.
Mr. President, does that mean you won't order Fort Sumter to surrender?
Please, one at a time.
Mr. President, I represent the Charleston Mercury. Do your remarks mean that you will not order Major Anderson to surrender Fort Sumter?
We may not think the same way about the Constitution in Charleston as we do in Springfield, but I think we speak the same brand of English.
Speaking is easy, Mr. President, but will you fight for Fort Sumter?
I do not anticipate bloodshed.
Mr. President, is it your opinion that the Confederate threat to fire on Fort Sumter is only a bluff?
I don't know. But if the threat is in earnest, I trust that saner men will not permit it to be carried out. I trust that the leaders of the South will prevail on the officers at Charleston not to plunge the nation into civil war.
Mr. President, the people of the South feel that your party is forcing a civil war by its stand on the issue of slavery. What about that, Mr. President?
The issue before the country is not slavery. I have said time and again that I have no intention of interfering with the institution of slavery in the states where it now exists. The issue is the continuation of the Union.
But on that point, Mr. President, Southern statesmen argue that nothing in the Constitution binds any state to remain in the Union.
Southern statesmen are trying to make the states' rights tale wag the Union dog. In my opinion, the Union is supreme. No combination of states can get out of the Union on their own motion. Resolutions to that effect are illegal.
Nevertheless, Mr. President, 6 Southern states have seceded. They claim Fort Sumter is Confederate property. Now, will you go to war to hold that property for the North?
Not for the North, sir, but for the Union. Under the Constitution of the United States. When I took the oath of office as president, I pledged myself to defend and preserve the Constitution. The Constitution will not be defended and preserved unless it is enforced and obeyed in every part of every one of the United States. And that includes Charleston, South Carolina.
Thank you, Mr. President.
President Lincoln has risen, indicating that the news conference is over. The correspondents are filing out. As you heard, no new orders will be telegraphed to Major Anderson at Fort Sumter. There may be civil war in a matter of minutes, unless the Confederate officers at Charleston are bluffing or are overruled by the Confederate government. Ken Roberts has been standing by at the executive mansion of President Jefferson Davis in Montgomery, Alabama, and he may have some news on that. We switch you now to the seat of the Confederate government in Montgomery, Alabama. Ken Roberts reporting.
President Jefferson Davis of the Confederate States of America will be with us in a moment. Right now, the President of the Southern Confederacy is in the office adjoining this anteroom speaking to members of his cabinet. The cabinet members hurried to the executive mansion when the latest report from Fort Sumter came over the telegraph wires a few minutes ago. Mr. Davis, as you probably know, is a former United States Senator, a general of the Mississippi Militia, and served as United States Secretary of War under President Pierce. Mr. Davis has entered this anteroom. The door has been closed. Mr. President, are you going to order Colonel Chestnut not to fire on Fort Sumter?
The authority to deal with the situation at Fort Sumter has been delegated to General Beauregard. It seems that General Beauregard has in turn delegated the authority to Colonel Chestnut.
Well, President Davis, as commander-in-chief of the Confederate forces, you can still intervene, can't you?
I have no desire to intervene.
The commander of Fort Sumter, Major Anderson, has agreed to surrender the fort in 3 days. Would you consider waiting 3 days before bombarding Sumter on the possibility that war might be avoided?
The fate of Fort Sumter, sir, will be settled at the Charleston level.
But if the colonel does open fire, won't the Confederacy stand responsible for having started a civil war?
If war breaks out, the responsibility will rest squarely on the shoulders of Abraham Lincoln. He has refused to recognize the sovereignty of the individual states. Mr. Lincoln has leveled a gun at the heart of the South. We cannot wait only for the sake of having him fire the first gun.
You feel then, Mr. Davis, that war between the United States and the Confederate States is inevitable?
Sir, we sent commissioners to Washington hoping to negotiate a peaceful withdrawal from the Union. They were scorned. Mr. Lincoln promised to withdraw his garrison from Fort Sumter. The promise was broken, as all Mr. Lincoln's promises have been broken. Mr. Lincoln will not permit a peaceful separation of the North and South. He prefers civil war to dissolution of the Union. And so he has created this situation at Fort Sumter as a war challenge to the Confederate States of America. The South, sir, cannot avoid that challenge with honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson Davis. The President of the Confederacy is rejoining the members of his cabinet in the other room. As you heard, it's up to Colonel James Chestnut in Charleston to decide whether or not Fort Sumter will be bombarded today. John Daly at Fort Johnson in Charleston Harbor reports that the Colonel's boat is drawing across the harbor toward those Confederate guns. Go ahead, John Daly.
Chestnut's boat is now only a few hundred yards away from us here at Fort Johnson, and in the gray light of the dawn, we can see his oarsmen pulling steadily in this direction on their trip from the fort here to the battery. The Stars and Stripes are still flying over Sumter, and if the bombardment of the fort is to take place, the signal gun will be fired from this mortar battery at Fort Johnson. The shot will be the signal for all the other batteries in the harbor to open fire on the fort. Sumter, you know, is in the center of the harbor, about 2,000 yards away. It's literally surrounded by the Confederate batteries. There's one to our right at Jane Island. Beyond that, still another battery at Cummings Point. The Morris Island guns. Across the harbor to my left are the Mount Pleasant guns, and to the right of them, the Fort Moultrie and Sullivan Island batteries. Hundreds of civilians of Charleston are lining the promenade at the battery, Charleston's waterfront. Others are on the city rooftops overlooking the harbor, and the streets have been gay and bright with the young ladies' gowns, young ladies who are charmed with their dashing cavaliers. Many of the ladies, by the way, have been busy already preparing comforts for the soldiers of the Confederacy. There is some sense of alarm among small segments of the population who seem to know what war may be like, but in the main, Charleston has had a great gala fete out of this preparation for the bombardment or non-bombardment of Fort Sumter. A crowd of several hundred excited civilians has gathered here at Fort Johnson, and here too is the Charleston Firemen's Band, which you've just heard. All Charleston has been making the Sumter affair a really gala event, and the band is here to see it through in complete style. With us is Captain George S. James, the Confederate officer in charge of these guns here at the fort. And Captain James, I should say, is about 30 years old. He wears the gray and blue uniform of the Palmetto Guards, a local unit of the South Carolina militia. Captain James tells me that he was an officer in the United States Army, but resigned his commission and joined the Army of the Confederate States 2 months ago. Captain James, as a former United States officer, how do you feel about firing on the United States flag?
I'm a West Pointer, sir. I served under that flag. Some of those men at Sumter are my very good friends and fellow officers. If I have to fire on the Stars and Stripes, sir, it'll be the most difficult thing I ever expect to do.
Well, do you think that Colonel Chestnut will give the command to open fire?
Yes, sir, I think he will.
Even though it will mean civil war?
Even though it will mean civil war, yes, sir. Oh, we didn't want this, sir, but the North forced us into it.
Well, how so, Captain J?
Well, the North intends to take away our property.
Your property?
They put an anti-slavery president into the White House, didn't they?
Oh, I see. By property, you mean slaves.
Certainly, I do mean slaves. I have 179 blacks on my plantation. Now, how long do you think I'll keep those slaves with Abe Lincoln running the country?
Well, hasn't Mr. Lincoln promised not to interfere with slavery in the states where it now exists? He said only that he is against extending slavery to the new Western territories.
That's what he says. But we Southerners know what he's after. First, he wants to stop white men from holding slave property in the Western territories. And then, when the territories come into the Union, they'll come in as free states. Anti-slavery states. That'll give the abolitionists enough votes in Congress to abolish slavery right here in the South. Southern slave property is worth $400 million. That's a mighty big investment. And it won't be safe until the South is recognized as an independent slave-holding nation.
Thank you, Captain James.
Thank you, sir.
Colonel Chestnut's boat has just reached the Fort Johnson landing below us here. He should be here shortly. And the Charleston's Fireman's Band has just struck up Dixie, the new minstrel song which has been sweeping the South. The crowd is joining in, singing the words rather defiantly. Let's listen. The new minstrel song by Dan Emmett, which is fast becoming something like a national anthem for the Confederacy. As you can hear, the band has already heightened the spirits of the gay crowd which has gathered here and been here for so many hours, waiting to see how this question is going to be resolved on the Charleston waterfront. The young ladies again are taking a leading part in the almost celebration that is continuous here along the Battery of Charleston and even here in the confines of the fort. The young ladies' bright and gay dresses and their high voices make a steady pattern of sound. While we were listening to the music, by the way, we noticed Judge James Pettigrew in the crowd, and the judge has agreed to an interview. He's here with us now. Judge Pettigrew is the leader of the pro-union men of South Carolina, one of the few pro-unionists in Charleston to escape being thrown into jail for expressing his views. The judge, a man of 72, has the respect of even his most violent political opponents, not only because of his advanced years and his service to the South, but also because he is universally recognized as the greatest legal authority in the United States. Judge Pettigrew, in your opinion, Colonel Chestnut and his party have just entered the fort. The four men are walking this way toward Captain James, who stands near the signal gun. And by the way, I'm told that the gun is already loaded and aimed, ready to fire on Fort Sumter if and when Colonel Chestnut gives the word. As he approaches now, Colonel Chestnut is talking to Congressman Pryor of Virginia. The congressman, as you know, is an ardent supporter of secession, famous for his denunciations of the abolitionists and a leader of the movement to take the state of Virginia out of the Union. Last night in Charleston, the congressman told a cheering crowd that if South Carolina strikes a blow, fires on Fort Sumter, Virginia will secede. And now Colonel Chestnut is speaking.
Captain James! Captain James, we are going to fire on Fort Sumter.
Yes, sir.
Congressman Pryor, will you...
Wait, gentlemen, wait. Colonel Chestnut, I warn you, if you fire that gun, you'll start a blaze that'll consume the South in everlasting flames.
Judge Pettigrew, I have the authorization of General Beauregard.
Authorization? Beauregard? Do you men realize what you're doing?
Judge Pettigrew, if you please.
Congressman Pryor has interrupted.
Judge Pettigrew, I respect your gray hair and your reputation. Yet I must warn you, sir, true sons of the South will not stand by much longer and allow a traitor in their midst.
Congressman, men like you are provoking a war which the South cannot win. If you fire that gun, you will thrust the South into war against the most powerful people on earth. In the name of heaven, think before... before you take an action that will slam the door on any hope of peace.
Sir, you speak eloquently about peace. But what about honor, sir? Would you have peace without honor? You say we cannot win a war against the North, and I tell you we'll trample them in the dust. Fire that gun and millions of loyal Southerners will flock to the banners. Virginia will secede. The border slave states will follow Virginia into the Confederacy. Weapons will come from England and France. I say annihilate this Union, stinking with corruption and tyranny. Fire the gun, and as surely as the morning sun rises, we will create on Southern soil a new nation, which will be the glory and envy of the world.
And the crowd is backing Congressman Pryor. They're crying out, fire the gun, give the signal for bombardment. Judge Pettigrew has thrown up his arms in a gesture of despair, of helplessness. He's walking away, shaking his head sadly, but the crowd ignores him. They're still calling for the firing of the gun. Colonel Chester is raising his arms for silence, shouting for the people to give him their attention, and the crowd is responding. Now, Colonel Chester.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's one man who most deserves the great privilege of firing the first gun on Fort Sumter. I refer, of course, to the distinguished congressman from Virginia, Mr. Pryor. Sir, do you accept the honor? I thank you, but I cannot fire the first shot of civil war.
Congressman Pryor, the most ardent advocate of war in the South, has refused to fire the first gun. The crowd is silent. It seems to be stunned. They don't know what to do, and it may be that even at
Captain
this last
James.
Moment... Colonel Chestnut again.
Captain James, fire the signal gun.
Captain James hesitates, but he is walking quickly to the signal gun. Now he's pulled the lanyard. The signal gun has been fired. The shell is mounting high into the air. We can follow it by the glare of its fuse, and it's dropping over Fort Sumter. It's going to hit inside the fort. Now the Cummings Point battery to my right has opened fire on the Fort Echo, the Moultrie batteries, the Sullivan Island guns, and now across the harbor to my left, the guns on Mount Pleasant. The bombardment of Fort Sumter has begun, and it means war between the United States and the Confederate States of America. Civil war. Here in Charleston Harbor, the war begins. Suddenly, these people here seem to have become aware of the tremendous and tragic implications of their silence.
Charleston, South Carolina, April 12th, 1861. The South fires on Fort Sumter.
You Are There, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 22nd of May, 1949 on CBS. You're listening to An Hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark LeVonier. And though several radio shows dramatized the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and background of his killer, John Wilkes Booth, according to my research, this next broadcast could be the only time dramatic radio has brought forth the story of the foiled assassination plot against President Lincoln, known as the Baltimore Plot. It was told on the Hallmark Playhouse on CBS Radio on February 9th, 1950.
Now Hallmark Playhouse, presenting Lincoln and the Baltimore Plot. Starring Victor Jory.
President Lincoln was newly elected, and he and his family were on their way to Washington for his inauguration. His journey was arranged to take him through five states. Like all of the presidents, he had a lot of friends, and he had more than his share of enemies. His train stopped for a night in Indianapolis, and he rode in a carriage with his wife and his friend, Ward Hill Lamont, through the crowded streets.
I'm going to be glad when we get to the hotel. I don't know when I've seen so many people on the street.
The president doesn't pass by often. It's something to tell your children. I saw the president on the way to his inauguration.
Well, I hope our sons are behaving themselves. I told Willie and Tad to stay seated and not to jump up and down and upset the driver.
They'll be all right. It's funny, isn't it, how like all the faces are. I've seen these same faces every place we've stopped. The faces of the ones that liked me and the faces of the ones that hated me. And the faces of the ones who believe I'll ruin the country and the ones that hope I might do something for it.
They'll all mighty soon see.
I wish I could say to them, give me a chance. Just give me a chance. I was born of country, earth, and open sky. I grew listening to the dreams of free men. If you'll just give me a chance, I'll put my hand to making some of those dreams come true. I don't want to take anything from the country. I just want a chance to give.
Well, if that's what you want to say, why don't you say it?
You can't say those things. All you can do is stand up before them and state your views and hope that they'll sense how you feel and give you a chance to live and...
To live? Well, you talk as though you expected them to try to kill you.
Nonsense. Well, there's the Bates Hotel up ahead, unless I'm very much mistaken.
That's it, all right.
We're stopping.
Let me get out of the carriage first.
No, I'll get out first.
Listen to them.
They love him.
Any one of them could have a gun.
Yes, any of them have.
Oh, I'll be glad when we get him back on that train.
What are you doing down here all by yourself?
Oh, just thinking.
Well, this is no way for a president to spend his birthday.
Even a president likes to get off to himself for a little quiet thinking once in a while. You know, I'm 52 years old today.
I had an idea that you were. You've been bragging about it all day.
Mm. You know, many, many years ago, there was a girl in Illinois, and she used to say to me, Abe, someday you'll be president.
Mother?
No, I didn't know your mother then. That was when I was young. Perhaps it was the last time I was young.
Where's the girl now?
Asleep. Out there.
Oh.
Days like this, we used to tramp across the fields, talking. Talking. Seems like we never stopped talking. Strange, I can't remember any of the things she said those days. But I can remember exactly how her voice sounded. The heart remembers longer than the mind. Words can be forgotten by the mind, but the heart hears the melody of a voice eternally. Well, I'd better get back to work. Your mother sent me after Tad and Willie. I forgot about it completely.
I forgot, too. She sent me to look for Tad, Willie, and you.
Mother!
Oh, hello, son.
Mother sent me to hunt for you and Bob and Willie.
Well, Willie's the only one that's lost now.
Willie isn't lost. He's up driving the train.
No.
Yes. He's got influence with the engineer.
Come on. Let's get him quick before your mother finds out.
Would any of you happen to have seen the President of the United States or his three sons?
We're going to collect Willie now, dear. He's up front talking politics.
Oh, at 10 years, he must talk a brilliant game of politics.
He talks a better game than some of these politicians talk. What's that newspaper in your hand, dear?
Oh, I was just reading the accounts of our reception in New York.
Oh, I see.
I have been standing judge of the president, the president's wife, and the president's son.
Hello, Hill. Who sent you?
Willie.
Willie?
Yes. He says you've all disappeared, and he's hunting for you. You'd better put in an appearance before he pulls the emergency cord and stops the train. And let me tell you, he can stop the train anytime he wants. He has influence with the engineer.
How did Willie get so much influence with the engineer?
The engineer wants to retire and be a postmaster.
Oh, I see.
And Willie has told him that he has a certain amount of influence with the incoming president of the United States.
Oh, you're going to have to spank that boy.
Why? He's telling the truth. He does have influence. Say, aren't we due in Philadelphia at 4 o'clock?
My goodness, is it that late?
Well, it's almost 4.
Well, all right, boys. Come with me and help get our things together.
Well, I wonder how Philadelphia is going to receive us. The strange thing being president, you never know whether it's a foe or a friend you're stepping off the train to meet. You never know. Dear, I've shaken so many hands tonight that my arm feels like it's going to drop off.
Well, we really should go back into the reception room.
Well, even the President of the United States is entitled to a few minutes to get a breath of fresh air.
Oh, here you are, Mr. President.
Hello, Hill.
Mr. President, I'm afraid I'll have to take you away from the reception for a few minutes.
Oh.
There's someone who has a message of great importance for you.
Oh, who is it?
It's Mr. Alan Pinkerton.
The detective?
Yes.
What does he want with the president?
Oh, it's purely a routine matter, Mrs. Lincoln.
You go in and entertain the guests, dear. I'll only be a few minutes. Pinkerton's a fine detective.
He's in the next room.
President, Mrs. Mellon.
How do you do, Mr. Pinkerton? Won't you sit down?
Thank you. Mr. Lincoln, as you may know, I've been in the employ of the Philadelphia, Wilmington, and Baltimore Railroad to guard the line.
Yes, I know, Mr. Pinkerton.
Recently, from some of my employees, I've had word of a concrete and definite plot to assassinate you on your way through Baltimore the day after tomorrow.
Oh? And who is it that's going to assassinate me?
The ringleader is a barber named Fernandino.
I never heard of him.
Neither have I.
He's the head of several treasonable secret military societies in Baltimore.
Hmm.
This plot, Mr. President, according to the conspirators themselves, even includes some of your Baltimore police escort.
Mr. Pinkerton became a member of the group for a time in order to find out what their plans were.
Fernandino says he'll immortalize himself by plunging a knife into your heart.
And is that the chief threat against my life, the half-crazed threat of a foreigner?
Don't underestimate this foreigner, Mr. President. It's a large group. They've worked out their plot in the greatest detail. I've had several men on the case, and their reports all coincide with mine.
I see. Well, how are they going to accomplish this deed that they have resolved on?
There'll be only a small police force at the railroad depot in Baltimore. A fight will start to draw off the policemen at the moment of your arrival. Then the assassins will close around you, and the deed will be accomplished.
Well, Mr. Pinkerton, accepting your statements at their face value, what do you propose to do about this?
I would like to take you to Washington tonight, secretly.
I can't do that, Mr. Pinkerton. Tomorrow morning, I'm scheduled to raise the flag over Independence Hall, and then I must visit the legislature at Harrisburg. I'm not going to run away in the night like a frightened schoolboy. I'll be the laughingstock of the country.
As the President of the United States, it seems to me you owe it to the country to take whatever precautions seem necessary for the preservation of your person.
Even at the risk of appearing a coward?
At any risk whatsoever. So I shall remain in Philadelphia, and perhaps, after your engagements tomorrow, you will reconsider.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pinkerton, but I doubt it. Now, come in and join the guests. Mr. Lamont will show you about, won't you, Hill?
It will be a pleasure.
If you'll excuse me, I'm going up to my room. I suddenly find myself a little tired.
President.
Who are you?
I'm Fred Seward, Mr. President. Your son, Bob, brought me up to your bedroom. He said it was the best place to talk to you confidentially.
Oh, I see.
My father sent me from Washington with some letters, which he said were of such importance that he would trust them to no one else. He said he would have come himself, but with the war situation looking more and more grave every day, he didn't feel that anyone could leave the Senate.
I understand. You are aware of the contents of these letters?
Yes, Mr. President.
Your father writes that a New York detective has reported that there is serious danger to me in Baltimore. A Chicago detective named Pinkerton told me the same thing about an assassination plot.
My father asked me to urge you not to go to Baltimore.
Well, I don't see how I can change my plans now. I must go through Baltimore. I must go through Baltimore.
The times were dangerous. The threat of storm rumbled low across the land, and history held her breath, waiting for it to break. President Lincoln paced back and forth in his room until the blood-red sun began to rise in the east. Then he went, as he had promised, to raise the flag over Independence Hall. There was a tenseness to the morning, but he refused to acknowledge it. He went inside to speak to the waiting crowd.
I am filled with deep emotion at finding myself standing in this place where were collected together the wisdom, the patriotism, the devotion to principle from which sprang the institutions under which we live,
liberty as a hope to all the world for all future time was the sentiment which guided those who met here. If this country cannot be saved without giving up that principle, I would rather be assassinated on this spot than surrender it.
That was a fine speech, Mr. President.
Thank you, Hill. Hill, I've decided to take Mr. Pinkerton's advice. I will let him arrange for me to go through Baltimore at a different hour.
I'm glad to hear you say that, Mr. President.
It goes against the grain, mind you. No man likes to appear a coward. And as a man, my pride would make me go straight to Baltimore. But as a president, pride is a luxury I cannot afford. I have much to do yet.
Not even the bravest of men would step deliberately into a cage of hungry lions.
Perhaps not. Did Pinkerton tell you any details of his plans about my departure for Washington?
Yes. He said last night that he saw no harm in you going to Harrisburg as long as you felt so strongly about your trip, but that he felt from Harrisburg you must go directly to Washington.
All right. Tell him to go ahead with his plans. I'll do whatever he wants me to do. Proud to see today the finest military array I think that I have ever seen, allow me to say in regard to those men that they give hope of what may be done when war is inevitable. But at the same time, allow me to express the hope that in the shedding of blood, their services may never be needed. Mary, I don't like to leave you.
I understand, dear. Mr. Pinkerton wants the rest of us to go on to Baltimore as originally planned.
Yes, Hill is waiting for me downstairs now.
Who's going with you?
No one.
Just Hill and you?
Yes, just Hill and me and one car and locomotive and one engineer.
Well, is that safe?
Pinkerton seems to think so. It's being done in the best detective fashion. There will be no lights, no communications. The telegraph linesmen have cut all the wires. No telegrams will be delivered in or out of Harrisburg until Mr. Pinkerton gives the word.
Will this train take you all the way to Washington?
No, just to Philadelphia. Pinkerton is going to meet us in Philadelphia and get us on the New York-Washington train.
Oh, God keep you.
And you. And the boys. Goodbye, my dear. A ghost train cutting its way through the night. Somehow it doesn't seem like the right kind of entrance for a president. A president should... Oh, well.
I know what you mean. The president should be standing in the sunlight. The band should be played. Well, history keeps changing. And the president has to do what the hour demands of him, just as you are doing. If anything happened to you, it would be the end of the country.
Don't you think it for one minute. This country isn't dependent on any one man. It isn't a leader that makes the country. It's the country that makes the leader. It isn't the man that makes the office of president. It's the office of president that makes the man. I am what the majority of the American people who elected me want me to be. When someone else takes my place, he'll be what the majority want him to be.
Well, a man has to have the makings of a president, and
if a man is a good American, then he has the makings of a president.
No, my friend, the loss of a single man can never hurt this nation. It will always put another man in office and go on. The nation may grieve, it may have a sense of loss, but it will go on.
Well, we don't want it to have to go on without you.
You know, I love this land of mine. And I love her voices. The voices of the storms and the winds. The voices of the hammer and the saw. Yes, and of the railroads splitting the prairie with the challenge of civilization. The voices of the people themselves. Arguing and growing by their own arguments. Learning more and more every day what freedom means and liberty. I hope I shall be listening to them for a long time yet. You know, I'm beginning to wonder if I ever will get to Washington. Maybe I'll be the first president that was assassinated before he was inaugurated.
I think, Mr. Pinkham, it's much too efficient to permit a thing like that to happen.
How sad it must be to love the people and to die at their hands.
There's Mr. Pinkerton over by the corner.
Well, I'm beginning to feel like a fugitive. Come on.
Ah, here you are, sir. Come with me.
Did you have a pleasant trip?
I've had pleasanter, but none quite so interesting.
Here we are. Now, if you, Mr. Lemon, will get in, we're going to the PW&B station. Well, you'll board a regular passenger train. This berth has been reserved by one of my women detectives. She said it was for her invalid brother, you.
I'm beginning to feel more and more like one.
Well, kindly remain in the berth with the curtains closed until you reach Washington. Above all, don't so much as stick a whisker out of the berth while the train is in Baltimore.
Yes, Mr. Pinkerton.
I shall be close by until you're safely in Washington.
Thank you. Believe me, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for all your efforts on my behalf.
Try to get some sleep, sir. I know this has all been a great deal of strain.
Yes, I will.
Well, we're on our way.
Yes, Mr. Lamont. Baltimore.
I think he's asleep. Well, so far, so good.
Yeah, one of my men just reported to me that all was well. Depot was perfectly quiet. Baltimore is asleep. Good night, Barbara Fernandino. Sleep deeply. The ships have passed in the night, and the hour and the man have escaped you.
Washington, D.C. Just a moment. I'll get off ahead of you, if you don't mind.
Where's Mother Pinkerton?
Were you asking for me, Mr. President? Welcome to Washington.
I might have known. Now, how did you get down there on the platform ahead of me?
He got off the car ahead. Well, let's get off.
Senator Seward is waiting at Willis to breakfast with you, Mr. President. He didn't want to cause any commotion by appearing on the platform.
How do you know he's waiting at Willard's?
The message was conveyed to me by certain sources.
Mr. Pinkerton, you are amazing.
Mr. Lincoln, may I return the compliment? My association with you shall always be one of my most treasured memories.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton.
Thank you, Mr. President. And now, this is where we say goodbye. The only thing I must do now is restore the telegraph service and send this message by code. Here, read it if you like.
This is to report the safe arrival in Washington of President Abraham Lincoln.
I'm very proud to have been able to give you a safe conduct into history. Mr. Lincoln, goodbye and good luck.
Goodbye, Mr. Pinkerton. I sincerely hope I shall prove to be worth all this trouble. Well, the plot failed, didn't it? The Baltimore plot failed.
Again with James Hilton.
Thank you, Victor Jory, for a truly memorable performance in tonight's story.
It was a pleasure to be here, Mr. Hilton, and to play Abraham Lincoln in this exciting adventure story from his life. The fact that it is one of the lesser-known incidents from Lincoln's life made it particularly intriguing to me.
That's about how we feel, Mr. Jory. With Lincoln's birthday just a few days away, it seemed to me to provide a fascinating drama as well as a timely one for Hallmark Playhouse. Until next Thursday, then, this is James Hilton saying good night.
The Hallmark Playhouse on Tuned to Yesterday from the 9th of February, 1950 on CBS. In its time, that program brought other stories of President Lincoln to radio, featuring Gregory Peck as young Lincoln in The Prairie Years in 1949 and Joseph Cotton in A Man for the Ages in 1951. And that closes this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be with us again for more programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levoner. Thanks for listening.